Welcome to Lit City. I'm Anna Williams.
And I'm Charity Nebbe.
Recently, as we were wandering through the aisles of one of our favorite places, Prairie Lights Bookstore, we decided to ask people a question. Why are we here?
We're going to save that question for later. We didn't ask them that. We wanted to know what draws people to the act of reading and what reading literature actually does for us.
So the first person we ran into just so happens to be an author. And
because this happens when you shop at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City.
Right. He is teaching currently at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. His name is Kevin Brockmeyer, and this is what he had to say.
What does reading give to me? Well, I'm a writer as well, and I always tell people that I'm a reader first and a writer second. And the reason for that, I think, is that I feel that I am best able to occupy and understand my own life when I read the books that speak the most intimately to me. And, you know, I could go through a whole list of what those books might be. I don't discover them all the time. I discover them only maybe half a dozen times a year. But that's often enough for me to feel that it's one of the most valuable methods by which I can understand my own experience.
So that part about understanding your own experience, that was echoed by other people we talked to.
I think it puts me in touch with my deepest self. I mean, I know that sounds kind of cliched, but it gives me this sort of interior space that is a dream space, even if I'm reading nonfiction, even if I'm reading journalism. It does that in a way that nothing else does. And I think it's because it's not, you can pace it. You can read at your own pace. You can stop and have your own images, your own thoughts, your own memories as you're reading. And I don't think there's anything else that does that.
While some people read to gain a deeper connection with themselves, others view reading as an escape.
Reading gives me safety from the rest of the world. It gives me a place to hide, and it also kind of gives me a barrier to put up between myself and everything that's going on.
I think what I like about reading the most is the way it fires my imagination. I create pictures in my mind. I can put myself in another place in time. I can identify with people I normally probably wouldn't even meet or know. You find a connection in reading that I don't think you can get sometimes through TV, maybe possibly through theater because it's live, but reading somehow is like a bowl of chicken noodle soup and a warm blanket and a comfort, I guess, is really what it is. And it's portable. And as long as you have a book, I don't think you're ever really alone.
So at the same time that reading can transport you into another place in time, it's also a way to stay connected to the people around you, to learn how to empathize, and maybe even feel a kind of spiritual connection with other members of mankind.
Exactly. And speaking of other places and times and spiritual connections to mankind, we're going to talk about the hippie movement and the 1960s counterculture today.
And we are going to start off by listening back to my interview with Mike Clausen, Associate Professor of Marketing at the University of Northern Iowa, and he's the author of the book Hippie Incorporated, The Misunderstood Subculture That Changed the Way We Live and Generated Billions of Dollars in the Process. Hello, Mike.
Good morning. How are you, Sherry?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
I want to dig into some of the really major ways that this hippie movement changed our culture. And we'll talk more about some of the products and the billions of dollars that came out of the ideas of this movement as well. But first, the term hippie wasn't one that came from within the community. Why were these people called hippies?
Well, you mean the name itself?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the name itself, the word hip was often applied to the African-American community in New York and San Francisco with respect to some of the early jazz players, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and even before that. So if you were hip, you know, that's where, you know, you were into that particular kind of culture. This preceded even the beatniks. the Beatniks kind of took it on and, you know, kind of worked it a little bit, hip this, hip that. But anyway, the word was primarily originated by a journalist who worked, like yourself, Charity, who worked for the San Francisco Chronicle by the name of Herb Kane. And Herb was very much in touch with everything that was going on in San Francisco at that time, including the hippies. And so in an original article, I'm just kind of blanking on the exact date, but I guess anybody could Google it, you'll find an article that he wrote about the what he called the hippies. And that's when the word was coined. And he said something to the effect, go down to Haight Street and get your hippie love beads or something like that. And it was just, you know, one of those things. He happened to do it. I think he coined several other terms, too. So Herb was kind of a genius in that way.
Did the hippies like the term?
No, they actually went by the term freaks. And that's what they really saw themselves as, too, kind of on the fringe. They were not interested particularly in social acceptance. They knew that they wouldn't be, and so they stayed on that fringe. You know, it's interesting, one of my students who had read my book this last semester said, do you think the hippies would have been different if people had accepted them from the very get-go? And it was a very interesting question, and I thought about, you know, those days and the people I knew, and I said, you know, I don't think the hippies really cared at all about what people thought of them. There was just that very strong lack of self-consciousness. They had a kind of a vision for what they wanted to do. If you wanted to jump on board, you're welcome. If not, well, go do your own thing, but we're not going to judge you, and you don't judge us either. And that's kind of the attitude they had, very, very high levels of self-confidence.
We started talking about how the hippies changed how we eat, and let's talk about some of the other ways. It's not just whole wheat bread. What were some of the other things that the hippies introduced that became a big part of our mainstream culture, food-wise?
Sure. Food-wise, yogurt was a very powerful contribution made by an original hippie by the name of Nancy Cameron. Nancy is still with us, and she is still making yogurt, and a lot of your listeners might, in fact, enjoy a brand called Nancy's Yogurt. Nancy's Yogurt in 2010 gross sales of $20 million. But, you know, Nancy and Chuck Kesey, who happens to be Ken's brother, are the owners of Nancy's Yogurt. They're up in Eugene, Oregon, or out in the country there next to where Ken grew up. And their product, really Nancy's product of yogurt, really changed, really set the tone for the yogurt industry for what it has become today. Immediately, Nancy understood the probiotic benefits of yogurt already back in the 1960s. And in many ways, Chuck and Kesey and Nancy Cameron can be basically attributed to this $20 billion plus $20 billion plus yogurt probiotic industry that just keeps going and going.
Wow.
So that would be another one. Yep. And then there's another person, if you want to hear a few more names.
Sure.
Fred Rohe, R-O-H-E, who is also still with us. He's very old at this point and not well, I'm afraid to sorry to say, but I had a nice interview with him. Fred came to San Francisco early, in the early 60s, from New York. He wanted to be a beatnik. He was from upstate New York, grew up in a small town. He wanted something different. And he said already back in 1962 he was a vegetarian, which you can imagine, excuse me, back in the 1950s he was a vegetarian. So this is rather odd when you think of teeny boppers and, you know, diners and all that.
Right.
This kid. So, again, you see these kids when they were kids and how they were just very different from their classmates, and they were ready to get out of there and do something different. Fred came to San Francisco and began working in a what they called those days a health food store. I think there's something called Greenfield, Waterloo area, that would be an example of a health food store. And these were stores that would just sell vitamin supplements. But Fred was not happy with that. He wanted to eat vegetarian food. He eventually bought out the health food store and turned it into the kind of store that he wanted, with fresh fruits and a deli that didn't have meat but was all vegetables. Well, today, basically, Fred may be seen as the pioneer of Whole Foods Market, Trader Joe's, and all of the natural organic food sections within the Hy-Vee stores. And also he went on from there. He didn't stop there. He also created not only the first natural organic supermarket, but also cafe, distribution center, and trade union. And when he was done with all of that, he went on and wrote books. And he is the guy who also pioneered the idea of running barefooted. So he's the barefoot guy. But the people who knew Fred at the time said he would sit in his store cross-legged in the produce section and chant Hare Krishna before he started his day. So you can see that this was the kind of a guy who was pretty much offbeat. And this is very, very typical of these folks. Very smart, knew exactly what he wanted. Nothing would stand in his way. And, you know, we often talk about the music industry with the hippies, but honest to goodness, it's a middling industry. The industries that Fred created today are worth nearly $300 billion.
Wow. Now, let's talk a little bit about music. You mentioned music. Of course, it's something that a lot of us think about with the hippies, that really a big sea change in music. They electrified folk, and things changed a lot. But I want to talk about a sideline to the music, because I think a lot of us kind of get what was going on with music. But lights shows, and you know, which, of course, have become that you see them everywhere, but the hippies pioneered light shows.
Absolutely, they did. And the person that was very, very instrumental in that is a guy by the name of Bill Hamm, who I count as a personal friend. I love Bill. I visit him every time I'm in San Francisco. And, Charity, you can think of it this way, that every light show you've ever seen, whether it was in a mega church or whether it was a Beijing Olympics $100 million show, or any kind of a rock and roll show, all of those shows can be traced back to one man. He's still alive. He's 81 years old. His name is Bill Hamm. And Bill basically perfected that technique and made history that way. And he's a wonderful man. Like I say, a grandpa and just a great, great guy. I enjoy him very much.
And he started with overhead projectors and transparencies?
And still does. Not transparencies, but he had, essentially, he was able to get what today, you know, we call an overhead projector, kind of like a classroom projector. At the time, I don't know what they called them. I don't think there were any overhead projectors in classrooms in the 60s that I can recall. But he was able to get a hold of one. A friend of his had one. And actually, he was a professor at San Francisco State University, this friend. And he said, I'm going to work on this technique as an artist. And Bill took it over. The light show, essentially, with Bill is very primitive, and it's the basis of all of the pyrotechnics that go on today. It's just simply an overhead projector. It's usually a large type of a Petri glass. His elements are oils, like olive oil, water, and various types of dyes. And with this, he creates these very, what I call, protoplasmic images on the wall. And so what it is kind of a spontaneous art that changes with every second.
Now, you mentioned mega churches, and that's something that, again, I had never thought about, how the hippie culture changed the way we worship in this country. Not completely, but many of the modern ways that we worship were inspired by the hippie movement. And again,
yes, that's right.
A lot of this goes back to LSD, which was a big part of the spirituality of the movement. Mm-hmm. But tell me how we see that today.
Well, one of the things that a lot of people have forgotten is that the hippies were very spiritual people. I don't mean like tangentially. I mean this was central to their being. They believed in a spiritual world. They believed in the existence of God. What they didn't believe in was organized religion. So what they did is they took what they believed was the best of Buddhism various other religions, including Christianity, and they went with what they believed were the best and the highest-minded morals and ethics of that religion. They were in love with Jesus Christ, but they had really no love at all for Christianity, if that makes some sense to you. So they would adopt these principles. One of the individuals who was, in fact, not only a believer in Jesus, but also a very strong born-again Christian, was a guy named Cecil Williams. And Cecil came to the San Francisco neighborhood in 1963 as a 21-year-old pastor. And Cecil had a lot of self-searching going on at that point as he saw the changes going on around him. Ultimately, what he said is we need to reach out to every person in this city, whether they be gay or straight, hippie or straight or whatever they may be. And what we're going to do is create a church here where everybody is invited to come to the table. And everybody can come as they are. They want to come barefooted, homeless, we don't care. Well, believe it or not, that idea alienated some of his early church members who said, we're out of here, we're not going to deal with this kind of crowd. And so we saw this happen time and time again. When I was a teenager, we saw this in churches. Hippies would come in barefoot, and then, you know, they would alienate people and so on and so forth. But anyway, Cecil persisted. He's still alive today. He has a congregation in San Francisco of 10,000 members, and they are the largest social service agency in San Francisco to this day. But what Cecil did is said, look, let's create a worship service where hippies will feel welcome. And so what he did on the morning of March 22nd, I believe it was, 1967, is essentially he created the very first what I would call mega church type of contemporary Christian worship experience with lights, with screens, with electronic music, using a lot of the popular music of the day, sometimes changing it, Christianizing the lyrics, and people were encouraged to come as they were, barefooted, jeans, whatever. It was a completely radical idea, and what I heard, it was standing room only.
And, of course, we still see those techniques.
Absolutely. It was the basis of today's contemporary Christian worship. Now, if it had stayed that way with Cecil, it may never have gotten out of San Francisco, but shortly thereafter, the Jesus People sprung up by a hippie couple. I forget his name. Her name was Liz. And they worked in a shop off Hay Street called The Living Room. And they just continued that work with Jesus Freaks, and eventually it went down south to L.A. And once the Jesus Freaks got to L.A., it was just became a national phenomenon.
So how do you define a hippie, if you can spot one anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, it's more of a personality type, and it's also an attitude towards life. It's a level of self-reliance. We do see this a lot with our millennial students. I've been teaching for 29 years. I've been involved with higher ed for 35 years. And I have not seen, except in the last 5 to 7 years, a group of students at the University of Northern Iowa that were as much like the hippies as this group is right now. Hmm. The millennials show very strong parallels to this group. I'll just give you a quick example. For most of the time that I've been at UNI, the issue for students has been building a career. We sometimes criticize students for being careerists, you know, and so on and so forth. Recently, I overheard a conversation with a student, and I just listened because I knew who she was, and I knew she was very bright. And one of my colleagues was saying, you know, I think I have a job offer for you if you're interested. It's with a trucking company in logistics and transportation. And he explained it to her, and it was a very, very good job, and a job that, I'll tell you, 10, 20 years ago, a student would just jump at it. And I heard her say after he was done, you know, I like that you've offered this to me. She said, but I'm just trying to figure out how I could even really be interested in something like this. And I thought to myself, oh, my gosh, I think I'm back in 1967 again. The money incentive is just not there in most cases. They want to make a difference. And what's so surprising about the millennials is that there's so many of them. There have always been a portion of hippies in every generation, but this generation has a lot of them. And we mistake them because we see them on their cell phones, and we see them, you know, texting and so on and so forth, and we think, oh, you know, just another generation of self-absorbed consumers. But when you dig under that surface a little bit, you're going to see some fairly thoughtful people, and a lot of them have that more bohemian streak to them.
Well, very interesting. I learned a lot today. Mike Clausen, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Mike Clausen, Associate Professor of Marketing at the University of Northern Iowa. I talked to him about his book, Hippie Incorporated, the misunderstood subculture that changed the way we live and generated billions of dollars in the process. And Anna, you are technically a millennial.
I think I do count as a millennial, yes.
All right. So do you agree with Mike that the hippie spirit lives on in the millennial generation?
You know, I really do. Almost as soon as I discovered the hippies, I think I was in about fourth grade, I almost immediately secretly wanted to be a hippie. I didn't quite understand everything that it meant, but I did know that I wanted to dress up as a flower child for Halloween that year, and I was not alone. There were several other girls around that age, 10 years old. We all dressed up this way with the homemade bell bottoms and tie-dye, and even after that kind of childhood connection with the hippie movement, the music of the 60s was something that was really important to me and all of my friends all through high school, all through college. So, yeah, I do think it's kind of a generational connection.
And I can definitely see some parallels between hipsters, which I wouldn't characterize you as one, but you know some hipsters and hippies. I can definitely see that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
All right, so coming up next, we are going to hear from someone else who was introduced to the counterculture movement by her parents. Her name is Claire Hoffman, and her family moved to Fairfield, Iowa in the early 1980s. And that was just a few years after the Maharshi University of Management relocated there. That is a school dedicated to the study of transcendental meditation. And Claire has written a memoir called Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood. I talked with her in July of 2016. Hello, Claire.
Hi, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to go way back in time to that story that your mother used to tell you when you were a little girl about the first time she laid eyes on Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. What was the story like? What did she tell you?
Well, it really was like a story of falling in love, and that the sense of, you know, fate suddenly taking hold happened for her, you know, and it's true. It changed her life and it changed my life. But she, you know, she was 19 years old and she was at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and she was waiting outside an auditorium. A friend of hers had said, hey, do you want to go meet this guru? And she had become interested in meditation recently, and she describes, you know, him walking by and stopping to say hello to her, and that connection, you know, him looking into her eyes as, you know, a profoundly spiritual experience, you know, a sense of total love and acceptance that she felt in that moment, and that sort of became the fire or engine that drove us to, you know, follow his teachings and move to Iowa.
So you wound up, after a couple stops along the way, you wound up in Fairfield, Iowa at the beginning of winter?
Yeah, well, it was January, so it's been a while since I lived in Iowa, but I think, is that the beginning or is that
No, that's the depths, the deep, deep, dark depths. Okay, so you arrived in the depths of winter, and the place you'd been just before that was Florida. So I know you were only 5 years old. You had a kindergartner's perspective on the world, but what did you think?
I was disappointed. You know, I think I had imagined living in New York and then in Florida and hearing my mom talk about Iowa, that it was going to be this sort of promised land. And I should say, I actually was born in Iowa because my dad was in graduate school at the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. So I ended up being born there, even though neither of them are from there. And this was before we got involved with, you know, Fairfield. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we moved there, and I just imagined it would be this sort of magical place that would be like a storybook, and I'd be allowed to go outside by myself and play, and it would just be sort of endless green fields of joyous grass. I don't know. And it was, you know, like 4 feet of dirty snowbanks, and, you know, people at that time in Fairfield, there was a lot of sort of animosity between the townies and the gurus, and it wasn't as I had imagined it.
Well, and you moved to Fairfield, and as you said, I mean, your father left you with nothing. So you moved to Fairfield with very little, and your mom was working extremely hard, making very little money, and you couldn't actually move into the community of the University of Management. You lived in Fairfield, the town, and you couldn't go to the private school, which is what your mom wanted for you. So you went to the public school in Fairfield. And Tell us a little bit about the animosity between the so-called townies, and they called you Ruse, short yeah. for gurus. And this was a lot of tension, a lot of friction, even in the kindergarten class.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in researching this book, I went back and went through the archives of the Fairfield Ledger and, you know, and even national press around it. But certainly in the Ledger, you see just this, you know, sense of outcry that that Fairfield had been invaded. And it was entirely localized in our kindergarten class. So, as you know, my first day, kids asked me, you know, are you a meditator? And, you know, does your mother fly? And I said, you know, yes, my mom's a meditator, and we're here so she can learn how to fly. And flying was this yogic flying technique that Maharishi said would create world peace. But, you know, I mean, everything about me felt, you know, weird and strange. And this was the third kindergarten I'd gone to in a year. And, you know, it just was, you know, the food I ate, the clothes I wore, I was, you know, I was just an outsider. I had come from, you know, New York and then Florida. And it just, I mean, I completely understand the sense of confusion for the people who live there to have all these people moving in from New York and California and Europe, you know, into their town with, like, pretty, at the time, wacky beliefs. And, you know, I think that had trickled down to the kids. So, you know, the kids at the public school would rattle the fence and scream at the kids walking to the private school. And there was a real sense of division. Some meditator kids threw, like, hijacked my brother and threw rocks at him when he was at the townie school. You know, it was a real back and forth.
As your mom was working just to feed and clothe you and keep you in a place to live, she was also trying to pursue her own TM practice, her own transcendental meditation practice. And of course, she meditated at home, but she really, really wanted to get involved in this special course, the program that would help her learn how to, quote, fly. I mean, that was her ultimate goal, wasn't it?
It was, I mean, ultimate goal. She that was when moving to Fairfield, that was the big idea, if you will. You know, in 1977, Maharishi really sort of changed the course of his movement. I mean, before that, in the 70s, about 8 million people had learned transcendental meditation, and that meant just 20 minutes of saying a mantra in the morning and 20 minutes saying a mantra in the afternoon. And it was a pretty simple and mainstream technique. And then in the 1970s, he came out with this advanced technique, his TM Cities program. And Cities, loosely translated, means superpowers. And the advertisements from the time, you know, said, like, the powers of invisibility, the strength of an elephant, and the ability to fly. And flying was really what he focused in on. And he had a mathematical formula that showed that if large groups of people practiced his yoga flying together, they would create world peace. And it was based on that mathematical formula, which he called the Maharishi effect, that he had people move to Fairfield. It was going to be these peace-creating groups, this sort of capital of his Age of Enlightenment. And so being there, you know, with my mom, she wanted to be doing more than just the basic intro-level TM. She really wanted to learn how to fly, but it cost thousands of dollars. You know, I think it's about $6,000 now, and I think it might have been $3,000 or $4,000 then. So it was really important. It felt like, you know, everyone was doing it. They built two giant golden dome shaped buildings, a men's dome and a women's dome. And people would go there for about 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the evening and practice yogic flying.
The price tag for that program was prohibitively high for a lot of people, and a lot of people came like pilgrims to Fairfield because they wanted to be a part of it. What was the reason that it was so expensive? Because the Maharishi had a specific reason.
Yeah, I mean, what I was told growing up, because sort of everything with Maharishi seemed to be expensive. I mean, that was the most expensive, but nothing was ever cheap. And the logic given was that Maharishi said that for Americans to value things, they had to pay a lot of money for it, which has obviously sort of worked both ways.
Right. And your mother was pursuing her own enlightenment, but she also firmly believed that this movement could change the world, right?
Yeah, I mean, everyone did. I, my mom's degree of faith in that, you know, it's she's revisited that question. But, you know, I mean, at the time, I think everyone felt like not only were they meditating all the time for themselves to, you know, change their consciousness or become enlightened, but also to create world peace. So, I mean, that's what I mean. Like, the sense of purpose was just, it's kind of hard to describe. You know, there's so much energy around it.
How long did you spend at the public school in Fairfield before you were able to go to the private school?
I was there about a year and a half, maybe a little bit more. It ended up being kindergarten through second, but only a little bit of kindergarten and a little bit of second, and then all of first.
And what changed that allowed you to go to the private school?
Yeah, like the flying program, a anonymous donor from the movement came in and donated money for my brother and I to go to the Murray Shoe School of the Age of Enlightenment, and we were so excited about it, you know. I mean, I think it was ended up being like one of many guys that was sort of in love with my mother who did. But yeah, it was, I mean, we were so jazzed and excited to kind of feel like we were finally a part of what was happening.
And at the same time, you mentioned that someone also, a benefactor, paid for your mom to pursue the flying course as well. So all of you were embarking on this new journey around the same time. And tell me what a day was like at your new school.
Yeah, so you arrived, and we started much later than the public school, which was, number one, awesome. So it started at like 9:30 in the morning, and we'd start with singing songs, you know, sort of about Maharishi or about his science of creative intelligence, which was his life philosophy. And then we would, you know, start meditating, do a group meditation together as kids. We all wore uniforms, so it was very organized. It wasn't like a, you know, sort of what you would imagine, like a hippie school where everyone's, you know, all around. He really liked a lot of parts of sort of old-fashioned Western education. So everyone wore uniforms. We would line up. We would sing songs with our hands folded on our desk. We would meditate for about 5 minutes, and then the first class of the day always was his sort of life philosophy class, the science of creative intelligence, where we would learn Maharishi's sort of theories about life, and these, you know, there were some basic principles and words that he felt like were integral to understanding the world. And from there, you know, we were meant to kind of go into our regular subjects, math and science or spelling. As time went on, you know, and the years went by at the school, more and more every class kind of became a Maharishi's philosophy class, like the SCI. It kind of really started to invade every subject. So even though we were doing math, we would be talking about how we could see Maharishi's principles in those math problems.
Your memories of those years, the early years at the school, seem to be extremely positive. Tell me how you felt about it. I mean, I know that you were excited to go, and you mentioned kind of it's a long, peaceful day. There weren't a lot of behavior problems at the school, and you were approached always with love, right?
Yeah, I think what part of my motivation for writing this book as a journalist is that you see all these books out there about, which totally understandably, but are about people who grew up in these sort of fringe religious communities and they escape, you know, and it's like they were a part of it and, you know, to whatever degree they were deluded, and then they come out and they sort of see the light and they look back and see everything as horrible. And for me, and oftentimes it is, I'm not demeaning that experience, but for me, you know, that's not what my experience was like. I was in it, and it was magical. It felt really wonderful to believe everything that Maharishi taught and to be a part of a belief community where everyone shared this sense of purpose and a belief that we were changing the world. Those beliefs felt really, really good.
As you got older, when did you start to have doubts? Because the doubts did come.
For me, my sort of moment, like lightning bolt moment, which it truly was when I was 12 years old. It was in November of 1989, and there was a school assembly, and the administrator of the school called all the kids into this special assembly, and there's a lot of excitement. Everyone gathers, and the administrator is sitting on the stage, and he's weeping tears of joy, and he announces to all of us that because of our meditations, the Berlin Wall had been torn down, that we had torn it down. And for me, I just knew it wasn't true. You know, I knew that my meditations had not been extra special or extra powerful, and I didn't believe it. I felt like we were taking credit for a world event that had absolutely nothing to do with us. And after that, things started to look really differently for me.
And there are a lot of years that intervene, a lot of experiences that intervene, but I do want to skip ahead to you as an adult, a very successful adult. You did go to college, and then you pursued two different higher degrees, at least two by my count, maybe more. All right. And, you know, you were a very successful journalist and writer and teacher and all of these things. And you look around yourself, and you're in California, and transcendental meditation is getting to be very popular. And you have some real mixed emotions at that point. What were your experiences like as you were struggling with people probably turning to you and saying, hey, teach us how to do this. You've done this.
Yeah. I know. I've never taught anyone to meditate. I am not trained in the art of teaching, although my husband can barely accept that, but I won't tell people like my mantra. I think what happened with TM is what you see so often with American spiritual groups where they're sort of fringe and crazy. So in the 1980s, you know, the idea of vegetarianism or yoga or meditation, you know, or natural foods or organic, I mean, all the things that the meditators were into that felt like weirdo stuff became or has been becoming normal and mainstream. To some degree, I mean, maybe that's the California talking, but to some degree. And, you know, what I saw was that, you know, people all around me were asking about meditation, wanting to learn to meditate. And I myself was sort of turning to meditation more and more, partially just because of having kids and being exhausted and really kind of looking for some sort of foundational part of my day to ground me. You know, I ended up coming back to Fairfield for a month when my daughter was a one-year-old, and so it was about 5 years ago, and taking Maharishi's advanced technique course, his Siddhis course, his yogic flying course, and it was, you know, it was a really powerful experience for me.
You had a real transcendental experience, though, when you did that. I mean, you really felt a powerful sense of joy.
I did. It's a strange thing to talk about, but it was because it was really personal in some ways. But I feel like I sort of was able to get out of my own head and the part of me that was judging everyone else and questioning what was going on and questioning the motives and have this really singular experience that felt sort of beyond logic or reason and was really beautiful. And for me, that experience felt like an opportunity also to kind of connect with my mother and really understand, and I don't want to say forgive, but some version of forgive everything that we went through, you know, because in that moment, what I experienced, I could see why she had been so motivated and felt so connected to this community and to these ideas, because the experience was really powerful and transcendent.
That was Claire Hoffman, author of the memoir Greetings from Utopia Park. We talked back in July about her experiences growing up in Fairfield, Iowa, home of the world-famous Transcendental Meditation Community.
And next week, we are going to be talking about another campus community that experienced some internal tensions.
Yes, significant internal tensions. We're going to talk with Lena and Michael Hill about their book, Invisible Hawkeyes, which tells the story of African-American students at the University of Iowa during the Civil Rights era.
And we're also going to hear from Jamie Schultz about his book Moments of Impact. And that is a book that highlights the struggles of some of the earliest African-American football players at Iowa College.
And those stories are heart-wrenching.
And we will be back next time.
Thank you for stopping by Lit City.